And when that rebirth consciousness springs up, it is associated with the other four aggregates. The material form aggregate is represented by materiality, rupa, the body of the newborn organism, in the case of a human rebirth, by the single fertilized egg. There's just this one fertilized cell, and now that cell is functioning as the physical basis of a living organism. Then, on the mental side, associated with the rebirth consciousness, the other three aggregates are found: feeling, perception, and the mental formation. These make up nama, mentality. So at the very moment of rebirth, it will be present, even in that one-celled fertilized egg, there will be present a distinct feeling, a perception, and several mental formations. And this complex of the five aggregates of consciousness and nama-rupa, consciousness and the rest of the psychophysical organism, this continues as an organized totality all the way through till death. Inseparable, all the factors dependent on one another, comes into being a living being, complete with all five aggregates. Then we come to the next link. Nama rupa pachaya salayatana. That is, with mentality, materiality as condition, the six sense faculties arise. Now, as the psychophysical organism grows and evolves, as it matures, there come into being the sense faculties. The sense faculties are six in number. There's the five physical sense organs: the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. Then there's the mind faculty, that is consciousness, considered as the organ of thought, of ideas, of conceptualization. In order to cognize images, ideas, concepts, as well as the other sense data, the mind functions as a faculty of cognition. So we have the six sense faculties, which come into being conditioned by nama-rupa, by the psychophysical organism. At the moment of conception itself, there is present the body faculty, the body as a sense faculty. And the mind-based, the mind faculty is also present, functioning as the rebirth consciousness. Then, as the organism evolves in the embryonic period, the other four sense faculties begin to take shape. As the cell multiplies and divides and takes on more specialized function, then the eye, ear, nose, and tongue emerge. And as they emerge, they make possible sense experience through those faculties. The body itself also becomes more complex and differentiated in this period. And then, coming to the next sequence, the next link, salayatana pachaya paso. That is, conditioned by the six sense faculties, contact arises. Now, to explain contact, we first have to say a few more words about the six sense faculties. The sense faculties serve as the means for gathering information about the world, information which enables us to survive, to function, to fulfill our purposes. Each faculty can receive the type of sense datum appropriate to itself. The eye receives forms, the ear sounds, the nose smells, the tongue tastes, the the body tangibles. The mind can deal with the objects of the other senses and also with its own kinds of objects, ideas, concepts, abstract notions, and so on. Now, conditioned by these six sense faculties, contact arises. And what is meant by this contact? Contact is the coming together of the particular type of consciousness with the appropriate sense object through the sense faculty. In dependence on the eye and forms, visual consciousness arises. In dependence on the ear and sounds, hearing consciousness arises. And so forth, in dependence on the mind and mind objects, mind or thought consciousness arises. The coming together of consciousness with the sense object through the sense faculty, that is contact. Contact is the conjunction or union of consciousness, object, and organ. Through the eye, consciousness contacts forms. Through the ear, it contacts sounds. Through the nose, it contacts smells. Through the tongue, it contacts taste. Through the body, tangibles. Through the mind faculty, it contacts ideas. Thus, there are these six kinds of contact corresponding to the six sense faculties. Then, pasapachaya vedana, in dependence on contact, feeling arises. Feeling arises conditioned by contact. Now, feeling, vedana, that is the affective tone by which the mind experiences the object. And there can be six kinds of feeling as determined by the organ through which the feeling arises. There's feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, feeling born of nose contact, feeling born of tongue contact, feeling born of body contact, feeling born of mind contact. By way of its affective quality, the feeling can be of three kinds. There's pleasant feeling, agreeable feeling. Then there's painful feeling or disagreeable feeling. Then there's indifferent feeling or neutral feeling. Why do these feelings arise? They arise because we have the psychophysical organism with its six sense faculties through which our minds contact the six kinds of sense objects. And some feeling is present on every occasion of experience. Whenever we see a sight, hear a sound, etc., some feeling is present, coloring our experience of the object. Sometimes the feeling might be faint and indistinct, but it is present all the same at every moment. It's through those feelings especially that our past karmas work themselves out, that they bring their fruits. Now, with feeling as condition, we come here now to the next link, Vedana Pachaya Tanha. With feeling as condition, craving arises. And with this link, we take a major step forward in the movement of the wheel of existence. For all the factors that we've mentioned from consciousness through feeling, consciousness, nama-rupa, the six sense faculties, contact and feeling, these represent the results of past karma, the maturation of our past volitional formations, which we performed and accumulated in the past life, and which are now germinating in the present and producing their fruits. As a result of our past ignorance and volitions, we've taken birth, acquired this body with its sense organs, and experienced the different kinds of feelings. All this comes about as a result of causes sown in the past. But now, with the arising of craving, we make a move from the resultant sequence of the past, having its effects in the present, to the causes operating in the present, generating a new existence in the future. In dependence on feeling, there arises craving. When our minds are covered over by ignorance and we experience pleasurable feelings, we become attached to those feelings. We enjoy them, relish them, and we crave for a continuation of this experience, or for a repetition of it, a renewal of it. Thus, craving arises, desiring or holding on to pleasure into the future. When we experience painful feelings, this pain awakens an aversion, a desire to eradicate the source of pain, to run away from it and smother it by indulging in more pleasurable sensations. And so, with the mind covered over by ignorance, the deluded person gets caught in the pattern of running away from pain and running in pursuit of pleasure, the pattern spelled out by craving. But this pattern, by which feeling leads into craving, this does not occur as a matter of strict necessity. This is a very, very important point that we come to. Between feeling and craving, there is a space which can become the battlefield where the rounds of existence, samsara, can be brought to an end. It is here, in this space, between feeling and craving, that the battle will be fought, which will determine whether bondage will continue indefinitely into the future, or whether it will be replaced by enlightenment and liberation. For if instead of yielding to craving, to the driving thirst for pleasure, if a person contemplates with mindfulness and awareness the nature of feeling, and understands these feelings as they are, then he can prevent craving from crystallizing and solidifying. He can prevent craving from arising and from sustaining renewed existence in the future. By employing wisdom, we can stop the process of becoming right at that point where feeling arises, preventing it from issuing in further craving and in renewed existence. So the link between feeling and craving, that is the vital meeting ground of the present sequence rooted in the past and the present causal sequence leading into the future. And it's here that the work of achieving liberation has to take place. This is the battleground where the defilements, the enemy, will be met by the army of the enlightenment factor. But now we're dealing with the forward movement of the round, and so we continue. Craving has arisen. Now is the next step. We have tanha pachaya upadana. That is, independence upon craving, clinging arises. What is this clinging? Clinging, upadana, is an intensification of craving. And the texts distinguish four types of clinging. One is clinging to sense pleasure. That is, we cling to the pleasurable feelings that arise, and we cling to the objects that give rise to these pleasures. The second type of clinging is clinging to views. We cling to our theories, to our opinions, to our conceptions, to our beliefs. We set up a scheme of categories through which we try to interpret reality to ourselves, to make things intelligible to ourselves. We hold and grasp that sphere. The third type of clinging is clinging to rules and observances. We cling to various precepts. We cling to rituals, to ascetic practices, whatever, with the notion that just following these rules blindly, performing these rituals blindly, that that's going to lead us to salvation. Of course, the rules might be important, the precepts necessary, the rituals might be helpful. The mistake lies in clinging to them with wrong views, with misunderstanding. Then the fourth type of clinging, the most fundamental type of clinging, this is the clinging to the notion of an ego entity, clinging to our mind and body as being a self or the belongings of a self. Now, clinging arises out of craving. And the difference between craving and clinging, this is illustrated by a simile. Craving, they say, craving is like a thief extending his hand to grasp some object that he intends to steal. Clinging, that is like the thief taking hold of the object, taking possession of the object. So at the stage of craving, the person is reaching out for the enjoyable object or for the idea or notion that he demands and needs. At the stage of clinging, he grasps hold of that object or that set of ideas, and he's appropriating it for himself. Then we come to the next sequence. Upadana paccaya bhava. That is, in dependence upon clinging, existence arises. Existence comes into being conditioned by clinging. What is meant here by existence, bhava, is the karmically accumulative side of existence, the phase of life in which we act, in which we accumulate karma, in which we generate more volitional formations, wholesome and unwholesome, the phase in which we build up these formations, accumulate them in the flow of consciousness, store them away in the ongoing flow of consciousness. When these karmas are accumulated through craving and clinging, then after death, these karmas bring about a new existence in the future. That is, bhava paccaya jati, in dependence upon existence, birth takes place. Through the karmically accumulative side of existence, through our stored up karmas, driven by craving and clinging, after death we reappear, for the stream of becoming goes on, taking a new birth. That new existence in the future begins with birth. That is given here as the 11th factor, jati. This future birth is to be brought about by the present craving, clinging, and the karmic accumulation. And birth, in the strict philosophical sense, consists in the future manifestation of the five aggregates, a rebirth consciousness together with nama-rupa, the mental and material factors. Then, in dependence on birth, then we have jati paccaya jara marana. In dependence on birth, there arises aging and death. That is, because we take birth in the future, then we have to pay the inevitable price. We have to undergo aging and death. And some of the texts mention not only aging and death, but sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So those are the 12 factors of dependent arising. And now we have some Having set out and explained the 12 factors, there are some additional considerations to be given to them. First, there is what is called the three links. These are quite obvious from what we've already said and need not be discussed at length. You can see them in the diagram. First, there is the link between the past causes and the present effects. That is the link between volitional formation and consciousness. Second, there is the link between the present effects and the present causes. This is the link between 7 and 8, feeling and craving. And thirdly, there is the link between the present causes and the future effects, between 10 and 11, existence and birth. The most important of these, as we mentioned, is the connection between the 7th and the 8th, between feeling and craving. Then the 12 factors are arranged into 4 groups with 20 modes. We saw that the causal factors of the past are ignorance and volitional formation. But when there is ignorance present, there is also craving and clinging. Craving and clinging don't belong only to the present life, but when in the past life, when our mind was covered over by ignorance, we also had craving and clinging. And so, along with ignorance in the past, we also had craving and clinging. Then the volitional formations, in effect, are the same thing as existence. Existence indicates the karmically accumulative side of life, and the predominant aspect of this side of life is the formation of karma through volition. So the two items, volitional formations and existence, these are really the same thing shown under different names and assigned to different lives. But when one is mentioned, the other is also implied. So then we get as causes in the past, along with the ignorance and the volitional formations, we have craving, clinging, and existence. These are the 5 causes in the past. Then in the present life, with the present effects, we have 5 consciousness, mentality, materiality, the sense faculties, contact, and feeling. Those are subject to birth, aging, and death. So birth, aging, and death are implicitly included. Then in the present causal section, when we have craving and clinging, what lies behind these? Ignorance. The reason we crave and cling to things is because we are ignorant about the true nature of things. And so when craving and clinging are mentioned, then ignorance is also implied. Then, as we said, existence is equivalent to the volitional formation. So thus, along with the 3 in the present, we have 2 other causes, that is, ignorance and volitional formation. Thus, we have 5 causes in the present. Then birth, aging, and death are events pertaining to consciousness, to the factors consciousness through feeling. That is, it's consciousness and the mental and material factors that are born. There's these that grow up, these that mature, these that grow old, and these that die. So when we speak of birth, aging, and death, we're referring to the factors consciousness and the material and mental state, including the senses, contact, and feeling. In that way, we get 5 effects in the future. Thus, we have these 4 groups, the 5 past causes which give rise to the present effects, then the present five causes which give rise to five more effects in the future. Thus we get four groups with 20 modes. And this whole sequence can be seen as repeating itself over and over again. You could apply it to any sequence of life. The 12 factors are again subdivided in another way into the three phases of the round. First, we have the phase of defilement, kilesavaka. That is ignorance, craving, and clinging, the defiling mental factors. Then, from this defiling phase, because the mind is ignorant, craves, and clings, the person engages in actions that bring about an accumulation of karma, karma which is productive of more existence in the future. Thus, this phase of karma functions as the cause for the third phase of the round, the phase of results, the phase of karma that includes the volitional formations in existence, numbers 2 to 10, that issues in the phase of results, which includes the other seven factors shown on the sheet. All the resultant factors from consciousness through to feeling and then birth, aging, and death. All of this comes about as the effect or result of karma built up in the previous existence, and that karma is motivated by the defilement. These three phases of the round function in a cyclical pattern. Defilements issue in karma, and karma issues in results. Defilements are the general cause for renewed existence, karma the specific cause. This new existence becomes the basis for more defilements, because of which we generate still more karma, and produce still another existence in the future. That is the basic genetic pattern, the reproductive pattern of samsara. That's why it continues over and over. But now there is one catch to this whole process of repeated existence. There is a way to bring this whole samsara to an end. The process of repeated existence doesn't have to continue. It all hinges upon a single underlying root. That root is ignorance. And it was the discovery of the Buddha, the most striking discovery of his enlightenment, that ignorance can be eliminated, that ignorance can be overcome. It is possible to generate a kind of knowledge, an understanding of the true nature of phenomena, an understanding which breaks through all the screens of delusions and distortions, a knowledge which sees phenomena as they really are. And by arousing this knowledge, this realization, the wisdom of enlightenment, ignorance can be eradicated. Ignorance can be eclipsed and annihilated. Then, with the cessation of ignorance, volitional formations come to an end. The liberated person, the arahant, acts. He's not completely passive. He uses his will, he decides, thinks, chooses, performs actions. But his acts of volition do not harden and solidify into volitional formations. They remain as mere functions or activities of the will without getting deposited in the mind as accumulation, as hardened formation. His volitions lose their potency of bringing about renewed existence in the future. The volitions of an ordinary person, of an unenlightened person, these can be compared to footprints left in wet cement. When the cement hardens, the footprints are retained. But the volitions of the liberated one, the Arahant, these are like the tracks of birds flying through the sky. No trace remains. His volitions don't harden into formation. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says of the Arahant, he says, those who do not accumulate, who have understood the nature of food, whose object is the void and unconditioned liberation, their track is hard to trace, like that of birds in the sky. Because he has aroused the wisdom of enlightenment, the Arahant, the liberated one, has eliminated ignorance and no longer forms volitional formation. Thus, with the cessation of ignorance, the volitional formation ceases. And because he's reached enlightenment, he no longer has any craving for renewed existence. And so, when he reaches the end of his lifetime, there is no precipitation of a rebirth consciousness. With the cessation of the volitional formation, the process of consciousness ceases. With the cessation of consciousness, there is no new mentality materiality, no psychophysical organism coming into being in the future. With the cessation of the psychophysical organism, there is no more sense faculties, no more contact, no more feeling. Since there's no more feeling, there's no more craving, no more clinging, no more accumulations of karma, no birth, and with the ending of birth, there's no more aging and death. All the dukkha, the suffering of the round, comes to an end. That is the cessation of suffering, the ending of the round. Now, turning to the practical implications of this teaching for our own practice. As we said, the most important factor is the link between feeling and craving. That is why the Buddha singles out craving as the origin of suffering in the Four Noble Truths. And so in terms of our own practice, what we have to do is to prevent feelings, the feelings that we undergo, from leading us into craving. And what is needed to do this, to prevent feeling from leading into craving, is mindfulness and clear comprehension of the feeling. We have to be mindful and clearly aware of the feelings that arise associated with our sense experience, and not buy into them, hold to them, and cling to them. If we lack the mindfulness and understanding, then when pleasant feeling arises, it will issue in craving. We relish the object, become attached to it, and desire more of the pleasure it gives. But if we have mindfulness, then we become aware a pleasant feeling has arisen. We stop at the awareness of the pleasant feeling without succumbing to it, without allowing the defilements to cluster around it. Then applying wisdom to our mindfulness, we understand the feeling is impermanent, unsatisfactory, without a self, insubstantial, merely an impersonal, egoless process. These measures prevent the feeling from giving rise to craving. Then as we go on cultivating wisdom, wisdom grows sharper and sharper, deeper and deeper, until it cuts off the basic ignorance, or cuts off layer after layer of ignorance. And when all the ignorance is eliminated, then the state of liberation can be achieved.